Good morning. How are y'all doing? I have to start with this morning is after 8 years, I finally get to teach in the big room. I'm so excited. Yes. And so I know, congratulations. Right. So I met with the clergy a couple weeks ago and I said, I'm so excited to do this. And their response was, it's wonderful. It's this best kept secret that we've kept from you all these years. So finally you get to cherish that. So with that, I just want to bake in how excited I am to be here this morning. Thank you all for being here. This is, you know, we talked about it this week about how amazing this is that our whole church gets together to kind of celebrate confirmation and kind of relearn what it means to be an Episcopalian. So thank you all for that. So what I'm going to do is I have to teach you church history from Jesus to about 1600 in about 40 minutes. So we're going to try to do it. Are you with me? Okay. So if you have any questions, ask me afterwards because we're not going to have time right now. Or if you're like, you want to raise your hand and say, Nick, that is not how it happened at all. Yeah, just don't do it in front of everybody for me, okay? So what we're going to do is we're going to start right away. Now, we know the story of Jesus because that's kind of where it begins, right? The life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. But I want to start the history of the church right after that with the Pentecost. Okay, we celebrate the Pentecost as the birthday of the church, right? Pentecost meaning 50 days, so this takes place about 50 days after the resurrection of Jesus. Jesus comes back, hangs out with his buddies for about 40 days, and then he ascends into heaven. Okay, and about 10 days later, a week later, we have all these guys who have followed Christ for, and they're all in a room, and some traditions say it's the same room where they had the Last Supper, some don't, but they're in a room together, and I call it this now what moment, right? Jesus came, he's gone, now what do? And the amazing thing happens is we get, if the Bible was a comic book, which you can buy, by the way, they do have it in comic book form, it would be like the first appearance of the Holy Spirit, okay? So the room gets filled with this atmosphere of fire, and they start speaking in languages that they don't understand at first, and then they start translating it themselves. People start speaking in all these different languages. Imagine the room here, and we started doing that, but we could understand each other. It was a crazy, crazy thing. Now, to kind of go back to the Old Testament, you remember the story of the Tower of Babel? Okay, if you don't, real quick, the story of the Tower of Babel is these people wanted to build a tower to heaven, right? They kind of wanted to be up there with God. And God punishes them by dispersing them throughout the world, speaking in different languages. This is kind of the culmination of that. They come back together, they're speaking in different languages, but they can actually understand each other. So at this moment, something is happening. I pressed my button, didn't I? So something is happening at this Pentecost. This is the birth of the church. This is the moment where a lot of disciples that have a hard time understanding what Christ is doing, they start getting it, right? And they start preaching the gospel. You have people like St. Peter preaching to the Jews, because at this time, the idea of Christianity is not a separate religion in itself. It's like a sect of Judaism, right? And then you have our namesake, St. Paul, going out into the world throughout the Mediterranean area and preaching the gospel of Jesus. Now, what happens between around that time, which is about 60 years after Jesus, to about 300, we don't have a lot of history, but we know that Christianity spread under the surface of the entire Western world, which is a really amazing thing to think about because there was no technology, right? The people spreading the word were not the Romans. They weren't the people in power. They simply spread this word by getting together at a table and meeting with each other and having meals together and loving on one another. And in 300 years, less than 300 years, it gets everywhere, okay? It's a really, really amazing thing. The Spirit is at work in that time. There are a lot of religions that come and go during this time, but Christianity sustains itself against all odds. So what happens is I'm actually going to do this thing that I do with the youth, and I'm going to have some of you guys help me out. So I'm going to create a timeline from the Pentecost all the way to the beginning of the Anglican Church, and I'm going to have people actually be my timeline. Are we cool with that? I'm a youth minister. We do activities. We just don't sit there, right? So I'm going to have somebody, Warren, I'm going to pick on you, man, because you're right here. I want you to be Mr. Pentecost, okay? I want you to hold it with this hand because you're going to reach this hand out because you're going to be a branch, right? Okay, we're making a family tree this morning. Okay, so what happens is, yeah, you might want to put your arm down. It's going to get tired after a while. Yeah. It's totally fine. So what happens is around 300 AD, you have a gentleman by the name of Constantine. Okay, Constantine was the emperor of Rome at the time, and he is responsible for declaring that Christianity can be tolerated. Okay, during up until this moment, if you said, hey, I'm a Christian, you could probably die doing that in public, okay? But not only that, but he actually said all religions are tolerated at this time. So there was this atmosphere of harmony within that, okay? And that was at the Edict of Milan in Italy that he met and said that. Then what happens is he kind of oversees in Turkey the Council of Nicaea, which is in what city? Nicaea, come on, of Nicaea, right? Okay, so what he does is he gets all these prefects and theologians and priests together, and they kind of get together and say, okay, what is this thing called Christianity? Okay, we're actually, it's something that's larger than just being a part of the Jewish nation. This is an actual religion in itself. So we need to sit down and figure out what it means to be a Christian. And they do that. They create, what did they create at the Council of Nicaea? Anybody? The Nicene Creed, right? You guys know this because you did it like 30 minutes ago, right? They sit down and say, what is the definition of Christianity? And they talk about the Trinitarian. They talk about who Christ is in relation to God, who the Holy Trinity is, the Holy Catholic and Apostolic Church, right? Forgiveness of sins. You guys know this stuff. We're Episcopalians. You know that stuff. So they sit down and figure that out. I need a Constantine. Philip, come on. You look like a Constantine. So you're going to stand here. And Warren, you can hold hands if you want. You can put your, whatever you guys want to do, okay? So you're Constantine. So it's kind of branching out to Constantine, okay? So what happens is the church actually starts getting bigger. About a couple decades after Constantine, Christianity becomes the state religion, and it gets huge. Constantine was, of course, a Christian. Some people debate whether or not that's because of his mom or he had some other conversion, but he really didn't come out to being a Christian until he was in his 40s, okay? So shortly after his death, it actually becomes a state religion for the first time, and it gets huge, okay? So what happens is when you create something, a lot of you people are business people, you have to organize it, right? You have to have committees and task forces and everything, and you have to sit together and talk, because we do that, right? So what happens is we split up the whole world of the Christian organization, the Catholic Church, into 12 kind of areas, okay? In each area, 12 is important, right? Because you have, what, 12 disciples, you have 12 kingdoms under Israel, so it's kind of an important number. You have these 12 areas, okay? And each one is headed up by an archbishop. Okay, so these archbishops are supposed to work together at the time. But what makes it very difficult is it's, what, 1,700 years ago. They don't have a lot of technology. They can't call each other. It's so the communication kind of breaks down, and so you don't have this hierarchy kind of holding it together. So they start thinking, maybe we need to have somebody who represents the entire church, somebody who's kind of like the lightning rod of the Holy Spirit that holds it all intact at this time. And so that's where we get the idea of the Pope. Now, what makes it difficult is they say, okay, this is going to happen. Who's going to be that? And of course, at that time, the Archbishop of Rome is like, well, Rome is kind of the center of everything, and we know we're the center of everything, and we think we're the center of everything, so we should be the center of everything. So that Archbishop becomes the Pope. And some of these groups don't like that very much, right? Some of these archbishops are like, why does Rome have to be the center of everything? They get all the attention. I'm tired of it. I'm living under their shadow, right? It's just like the second kid, right? Why does anyway. So you have that. So you have this tension between these 12 areas, and what happens is around 1054, you get what we call the Great Schism. Okay, the Great Schism is the first big split in the Catholic Church. Now, when I say Catholic Church, I mean universal Catholic, not Roman Catholic yet, okay? That starts, the Roman Catholic Church starts around this time, okay? On a side note, when I give you guys dates, like 1054, it doesn't mean that all of the schism happened in 1054, okay? It had been bubbling up for years, and there's ramifications for years to come. When we get to the Reformation, it's the same way. This is kind of the climax of that, okay? When they make a declaration saying, we are no longer going to be under the Pope's reign, we're going to be our own churches, and that's where we get the Roman Catholic split and the Orthodox split. So I need a Roman Catholic. I'm going to have my wife come and be Roman Catholic. Come here. You can yell at me later. Okay, who wants to be, here, come here, you can be Orthodox for a while. Okay, so what I want you to do is you have to, okay, you have your hand there. This is where it's going to get complicated. You need to kneel down here, okay? You're going to be Orthodox, okay? Put your hand out here, right there, because that's the split right there. You guys see it? Actually, Danny, you're making it do that. Hold hands. It's okay. I trust you. Okay, so the split is right here. This is the Great Schism. We split up here. The reason why this is important is because a lot of people ask me about the Orthodox Church. Are they Christian? Yes, they are. They're part of our Christian umbrella. As a matter of fact, their style of worship and liturgy is very close to the antiquity of the Catholic Church at that time. They kind of kept with that. So you guys, especially it's important in Winston, right? Because we have a huge Greek Orthodox place. You've probably been to the festival and had their food and witnessed their awesome music, right? But you also have Russian Orthodox, Armenian Orthodox, and the biggest difference between these churches are culturally based and particularly language based, okay? A lot of them do liturgy and their polity is very, very similar. It's just that their culture is embedded in that particular church and they use the native language of that. Okay, so Russian Orthodox would use Russian, right? Okay, so you getting tired yet? You can take a break, okay? But the schism still remains. Okay, so then what happens is before the Reformation, we have a small group of people that break off from the Roman Catholic Church. They really don't find their identity in there anymore, and they're in the Germanic area, and so they want to join the Orthodox traditions, and the Orthodox churches are saying, you know, it's too little, too late. We don't want you part of it either. So they try to go back to the Roman Catholic Church, and the Roman Catholics are like, no, 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 no. You can't just leave and come back. So they start their own religion. It's a small religion, but it's an important religion for our area, and that's what we have, the Moravians. And they kind of evolve to what they are today. I'm not going to get into too much detail, but the important thing is to understand that they are still a part of our Christian heritage. And they're kind of the first reformers. We can give them that credit. They kind of broke off before everything else did, about 100, 100 and a half years before the big Reformation. Okay, so that's where the Moravians come from. So then what happens is about 500 years later, we have the Reformation with a whole bunch of really, really good-looking people, right? And the Reformation, anybody know when the Reformation starts? This should be really easy, by the way. What's that? 15, close, very close. When does it start? Anybody? 1517, 500 years ago this year. Isn't that awesome? I have a Martin Luther action figure in my office that has that commemoration. So Of course, you got to find it between all the other action figures. So what happens is 500 years ago this year, as a matter of fact, 500 years ago this Halloween, the eve of All Saints Day, how many of you are going to dress up like Martin Luther for Halloween now this year, right? Okay, I know all my youth are. I feel I have to until my kids make me do something else. So about 500 years ago, Martin Luther goes to this church, okay, in Wittenberg, Germany, All Saints Roman Catholic Church, and he goes to this door. And this is like the traditional idea, and you guys probably know where I'm coming from. He writes down what we call the 95 theses. The 95 theses are, I have 95 ideas about what's wrong with the church at this time, is really what it is. Now, it's not as dramatic as you think. It's not like the clouds parted and everybody stopped to watch him do this thing. It's not like a Cecil B. DeMille movie or anything like that. That was probably a community cork board at the time. There were a lot of things on that. So it was very traditional to put like things up there. Now, what made it a big deal was is he was challenging the church at that time. Now, what really got things going was is he took the same theses and he mailed them to his archbishop. And that's how the hierarchy got to know what he was up to. If he would have left it there, it probably just would have blew away in the wind. But the big thing is that he actually mailed it to them and got it. They did not like that very much. He became a fugitive and he had to hide for quite a while, okay, because they wanted to kill him. Yay, church history. Okay, so what happened is he wanted to challenge a couple things. So the Reformation has these major pillars in which it represents, okay? I want to talk about a couple of those real quickly. I call them the three solas, okay? Solas meaning only, okay? The first one, you guys could probably translate it yourself, is the idea of sola scriptura, okay? Sola scriptura means only scripture. Now, when we hear the idea, particularly in the 20th century, and we think of sola scriptura, we think that we only use the Bible. That's the only thing we use, right? And a lot of fundamental churches will say that. But what Martin Luther was really talking about is the context of over tradition. He's saying that we need to go back to the scripture because we're starting to worship tradition a little too much, okay? And he actually wanted the scripture to go to the people, right? Because at the time, it was only in Latin and most people didn't know how to read. So you probably had a lot of priests reading the Bible the way they wanted to read it, maybe making up some stories, who knows? Okay, so he wanted that to go to the people. The other one is sola fide, which means only faith. And in the context of that, it's only faith over works. The big idea of the Reformation is you guys have probably heard what's called justification, okay? A lot of traditions use this in different ways. This is the moment where you realize that Christ is in your life, right? The moment where some people say, when were you saved? We don't need to talk about that theology, but that's kind of, you know, the moment, you know, where you accepted Jesus like a friend on Facebook, you know, things like that, okay? That's that moment. So he says that faith is important to do that. Now, works is a response to that, right? Works is a symbol of your faith. So he's kind of getting back to the roots of early church theology. And then the last one is sola gratia, which means only grace in the context of over merit. And you guys can probably figure out what that is, okay? Is grace alone, only through grace can we achieve salvation. What he's doing here is giving Christ the authority back, right? He's saying it's what Christ has done. Christ has given us that grace. We don't earn it. Okay, now what's going on with the church at the time, the Roman Catholic Church, is they are doing all these things, you're creating all these ideas in order to gain money and authority, and they have what we call selling indulgences, which is basically, here's a ticket to heaven, just give the church enough money, and reformers like Martin Luther had a huge problem with that, right? So those are the three main pillars of that. I need a Moravian real quick. Who wants to be a Moravian? Come on. Vance, come on. Yeah, you guys should learn not to give me eye contact because then I grab you, okay? So I need a Moravian. Man, you guys aren't holding hands anymore? Okay, now the Moravian is good. You're just going to stand right here, okay? You don't need to hold hands because you're kind of offshoot of the Roman Catholics. You can even put your hand on Dana's shoulder. That's okay. I'll give you permission. Okay, so, and then I need somebody to be the beautiful Martin Luther. Who wants to be Martin Luther? I need somebody. Somebody, come on. Come on. You knew you were going to come. You knew it was going to happen some point. When I started doing this, you're like, man, why did I sit up front? Okay, so you got Martin Luther, okay? And you're actually would be holding hands with Dana, but you don't have to. It's totally fine, okay? So then what we get is we get the second generation of reformers, okay? John Calvin is part of that response to the Reformation. If you notice his age in 1509, he was a child when the Reformation started, so he's kind of like that second generation of reformers, okay? Real quick. What denomination came from Martin Luther? I meant to get that. Anybody? Lutherans, right? All right. Hey, look at that. Okay, so when you know any Lutheran brothers and sisters, you understand that they come from the idea of Martin Luther, and their biggest thing is the idea of justification or faith. Okay, so then you get John Calvin. John Calvin, his biggest thing is the idea of predestination. Okay, there are other things too, like total depravity, which was just a little dark for Sunday morning, things like that. But his biggest theological difference is the idea of predestination. Now, that doesn't mean that God knows what you're going to have for lunch today, okay? You might, who knows? But what it means is God has a particular elect in which have already been chosen to achieve salvation, okay? Some of you probably have a problem with that, and that's okay. Some of you might not, and that's the beauty of the Episcopal Church, ladies and gentlemen. You can agree with it or not. It's really kind of cool, going back to what Dixon talked about. Now, I will say, if you've ever read any of John Calvin's stuff, he's a really good writer. He's very compelling, and he actually did struggle with this idea, but that was kind of the conclusion he had. So, John Calvin, I need a John Calvin. Who wants to be my John Calvin? Yay, Helen from the back. Look at that. Give her a round of applause, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah, she's taking one for the team for you guys. Thank you. Look at that. You guys look just alike. Okay, so you have John Calvin. Now, John Calvin is responsible for this particular denomination. You might have seen that symbol in some of the churches here in Winston-Salem. They are the Presbyterian Church. Okay, so that's kind of like the big distinction in the Presbyterian Church. Now, it doesn't mean that all Presbyterians believe in predestination. That's just one of the doctrines they have. Okay, and in recent history, the Presbyterian Church has sub-denominations. So it's not, they're not, everybody who is considered Presbyterian might not be connected with another Presbyterian church. The largest denomination is the PCUSA, and that's theirs right there, their symbol. Okay, you guys probably know some of them. Now, I need somebody, who are my Baptists? Some of you guys grew up Baptist. Come on, this should be like native to you. Come on. All right, there. Come on. Come on, Mom. No, that's really my mom. It's not like a term of endearment to somebody I know in the church. Okay. Okay, so we have the Baptists, okay? They are very, very unique. I'm going to have you stand here. Helen, can you hold that for me so I can walk around? I can't stand still. Okay, so the Baptists are uniquely American, okay? They're more of a grassroots organic denomination. As a matter of fact, they would not claim to be a part of this, okay? They would not be a part of the Apostolic Succession. They would say, this is a mess. We're kind of starting from scratch, okay? So the Baptists, their biggest thing is, and that symbol right there is the symbol to the Southern Baptist Convention. Now, not all Baptist churches are connected either. There are thousands of Baptist denominations, some of them as big as only one church. It is a loosely based a title for a church. The biggest denomination is the Southern Baptist. If you put all the Baptists together, that would be the largest denomination in the United States. But, of course, the Methodists wouldn't want to, because if you split them all up, then they are. So it kind of gets in semantics. The Baptists, their biggest theological thing was that you had to believe in believer's baptism. Okay? They probably don't have confirmation because it doesn't make sense. Because they say, when you get to the point to make your decision whether or not you want to dedicate your life to the church in Jesus Christ, that's when you get baptized. Okay, so they don't baptize infants. Now, today, some Baptist churches actually do. They've moved away from that. But that's the theological idea on why the Baptists kind of started. Okay, you with me on that? Okay, a lot of you know Baptists, I'm sure. We're in the South, right? Throw a stone, you're going to hit one. Okay, so the next thing is, I need somebody to be Henry VIII. Who wants to be Henry VIII? He's a looker, man. Like, didn't they think he's a superhero in that picture? The Dixon and I decided that we had to put that picture on there because he really is kind of full of himself in that. He's holding a sword. He's holding one glove. Why, I don't know. All right, thank you, Margaret. I know he's your favorite. You tell me all the time. Okay, so, and we're going to go back to Henry VIII. Don't worry, we got plenty to talk about with Henry VIII. But Henry VIII, shortly after the Reformation, was the King of England. And he wanted to have his marriage annulled, which we'll talk about later on, and the Pope said nay. And he said, you know what, I'm going to take my archbishop, and I'm going to be the head of the church, and we're going to totally separate ourselves from the Roman Catholic Church. And that's where you eventually get the Episcopal Church, right? Remember Dixon talking about last week how the Episcopal Church is the American branch of the Church of England, right? We don't use the term Anglican because what happened in the 1700s, we had that thing called the Revolutionary War, where we didn't want to associate ourselves with the British Empire. So we got really small at that time, too. We're actually going to eventually talk about the Episcopal Shield, believe it or not. All these things matter in that. It's part of our heritage. But if you notice, it kind of looks like the American flag a little bit, right? A little bit. So the people that were part of the Episcopal Church, created the episcopacy we'll talk about, are also the same people who started the American government. Okay, the Episcopal Church is embedded into the zeitgeist of the American culture. Okay, no matter how small we are, we're still part of that. So, I have talked about how we've gotten to this point, but one other thing I want to add is that other denominations have come from us too. Okay, so in the late 1700s, we had an Anglican priest by the name of Jonathan Wesley. Okay, and he was an Anglican priest till the day he died. I don't care what Methodists say. Okay, he's just as much ours as theirs. He was British, and his thoughts were, we need to get out of the church walls some more. We need to evangelize and spread this gospel. Okay, and so what they did is they started groups of Anglicans called the Methodists. They were still Anglican. Okay, they were still Episcopalian, and they got out into the walls. Now, John Wesley also had a couple theological uniqueness. He believed in something called prevenient grace, which is the idea that God is still working within you even before you understand how God works. And as Episcopalians, you can adopt that. I have. But there's a couple other theological uniquenesses he has with that. He emphasizes on the idea of human experience to recognize God in our lives. Okay? So he really does not want to start another denomination. And if you notice, reformers, it's kind of like this historical thing. Reformers never want to start something new. They want to reform what they already love, right? Martin Luther never wanted to change or start a whole new reformation. He wanted to reform the Roman Catholic Church. You know, Jesus didn't even want to start a new religion. He wanted to reform Judaism. So John Wesley, till the day he died, claimed that the Methodist movement was still within the Anglican umbrella. And the joke in seminary was that the United Methodist Church started the day after he died. Because after he died, they're like, nope, we're gone. We're out of here, okay? So that's where you get from the Methodists. So you all know people from Centenary, you all know Methodists. So after this class and you go see them for lunch or whatever, you can say, you're welcome, Methodists, because if not for us, and you like how I have wine too, it's such an Episcopal thing, right? Is without us, they don't exist, okay? And John Wesley is ours. They can claim him all he wants, okay? How much time do I got? I got a little bit of time. Okay, so now I'm going to go to the second half. We have that. Let's give these guys a round of applause for standing here with pictures. Awesome. Thank you. All right. Helen, can you get all those for me? Yeah. Thank you. Okay, you guys can go sit down. You may be seated. Happy birthday. All right. So, high five. I know you're mad at me now, right? So, the second part is, and I know I'm speaking very quickly, but I timed this thing at like 45 minutes last night, so I'm trying to truck through it, okay? Is we have what I call fun with the tutors, okay? How many of you have ever seen that TV show? Okay. I also like to call it the real Game of Thrones, okay? If you've ever seen Game of Thrones, you're like, this is kind of like the birth of the Episcopal Anglican tradition, right? It's without the dragons, of course, even though maybe. I'm not sure. So I'm going to truck through this real quick. There's nothing romantic about this, but I want to say this. Throughout all the messiness of the birth of the Church of England, the Holy Spirit is still at work within that. And after you hear kind of what I have to say, and after Dixon teaching History of the Church Part 2, the sequel, Electric Boogaloo, next week, is I want you to kind of look at all that mess and see how the Spirit is working in that. It really is kind of a beautiful story. So we start with this stud, right? King Henry VIII, okay? The King of England in the early 1500s. I'm going to kind of give you an idea of who he marries, what his kids are, and then I'll kind of tell you the story of that. So he marries a lady by the name of Catherine Aragon. Sounds like something from Lord of the Rings, okay? She has one child, and that is Mary. She's a looker. She makes my hairline look awesome, right? She looks a little bit like John Malkovich. That's okay. Okay? So, but the hard part is that he needs an heir, and he wants a boy. And Catherine does not have a boy. She has a lot of stillbirths, and it was actually a blessing in disguise that Mary even survived. She did have one boy, and he lasted a couple months. I mean, keep in mind back then, they didn't have the technology and the medicine. So she knew she was on a timetable. He knew he was on a timetable. So he wanted to get the marriage annulled because he wanted to get moving. Okay? I'm going to get back to that annulment in just a second. After that, though, he married Anne Boleyn. Okay, some of you guys probably know some of these stories. Anne was the sister of his mistress. He kind of kept it in the family, right? Okay, he fell in love with Anne. Anne gave birth to Elizabeth I. You guys are probably familiar with her. You've seen some of the movies. Okay, then he marries Jane Seymour, not the actress. And they finally have a son, Edward. Okay, he's a youngin'. We're going to get back into his story. But then he marries again. He marries another Anne. He marries another Catherine. And then another Catherine. The reason why I say this is if you happen to be on a trivia night sometime and they say, which wife of King Henry VIII, you have a 50-50 shot of winning over Catherine, right? And there's two Annes, so it's like he didn't want to mess up on their names when he remarried somebody. It's fascinating. So out of his six wives, he was married to three Catherines, two Annes, and one Jane. So what happens is Henry, of course, we go back to Catherine of Aragon from Lord of the Rings. She does not provide a male heir for him. So he wants to get an annulment, okay? We know what annulments are, but he has to get permission from the Pope at the time to do that because they don't believe in divorce, they're Roman Catholic. So he goes to Pope Clement to ask for an annulment. And that's what he wants, of course. And Pope Clement says no, okay? Now, before that, he actually gets his Archbishop Thomas Cranmer to kind of think of this theological, scriptural reason to do so, and he goes to the Pope and gives him that, and the Pope still denies him. And there are arguments on whether or not Cranmer's, and we're going to talk about Cranmer, don't worry, Cranmer's argument wasn't sound enough, or if he just sincerely didn't believe in the annulment. But also, is Catherine's nephew was the Emperor of Spain and Rome at the time. So it was a very precarious position for the bishop to be in, and he probably didn't want to upset that side of the family either. So he decided to say, no, you're not going to be annulled. And Henry says, of course, fine, I'll annul it myself, because now I am the head of the Church of England. Okay? And they break that up. Now, his archbishop, Thomas Cranmer, how many of you know that name? Right? Cradle Episcopalians know that name, right? He started a little book called the Book of Common Prayer. Okay, that's that book we have that when other people from other denominations are wondering where the Bible are in our pews, we say, no, we have this one. Okay, he starts writing this at that time, and it takes him a little bit of time. But what happens is Henry eventually dies, and his son, Edward, takes over. Now, when Edward takes over, he's 9. So he's kind of like that one kid in Game of Thrones, maybe not as mean, but he has all these other people kind of running everything for him, and eventually he's going to be the king that Henry wanted to have. During that time, Cranmer is still the archbishop. the Protestant movement of the Church of England is still present. They're going to continue that. And he finishes the Book of Common Prayer during Edward's reign. And he also does what we call the 39 Articles. Now, if you ever look in the back of the Book of Common Prayer, we have the 39 Articles. And some people would say, well, that's your doctrine, right? Those are your statements of faith. And that's really not what they're there for. Cranmer wrote them in response to what is going on in the Catholic Church and the Reformation at the time, okay? They're very open. They're not like, this is what we believe. We believe in this. There's one that article that's like, we believe in Jesus. You know, that's a pretty good one to start with, right? There's one that say we are deeply Trinitarian. So they're kind of affirming that they're a part of that family history that I shared with you, okay? They have one on predestination saying, hey, it's there. You know, they have one on free will, which is the opposite, saying, hey, that's there too. You know, so I encourage you guys to look at those. They're important. Dixon will probably touch on them a little bit more. If not now, he will. So what happens is those get finished, but Edward, oh, come on, technology, right? Edward dies at the age of 15. He dies very, very young. And so Henry has two more heirs. And according to tradition and law, then it would be his oldest daughter, which is Mary the Looker, I like to call. Okay? Mary takes over. The problem with this is that Mary is deeply Roman Catholic. Okay? And so she has a problem with this whole Church of England thing that her dad started and starts having dialogue with the Pope again, bringing back the Catholicism as the state religion of England. That sounds great. That sounds like a great story of reconciliation. Hey, we're back together and everything. But what she does is she starts persecuting and murdering all the Protestant leaders at that time. It was awesome. That's where you get the nickname Bloody Mary, because she was kind of responsible for being a little bloody. People got scared of her. She didn't handle it very, very well. Now, Mary, she was a little crazy, I would say. She pretended to be pregnant for a while a couple times, and people were like, why is she getting bigger? And then she would go away. Like, it was a very odd thing. But then what happened was she felt that she was pregnant. She started getting bigger. She was getting morning sickness, and she was like, all right, this is actually happening. I'm going to have an heir. What's also happening at this time is we have Protestant rebellions in the Church of England, okay? It's kind of like if you saw the new Star Wars movie, it's just like that, exactly like that, right? And she's kind of Darth Vader, maybe a little scarier, okay? But the rebellions they're rebelling in the name of Elizabeth, okay? Now, you can argue whether or not Elizabeth was part of that, being the Princess Leia and fighting with them as well. But the threat to her was Elizabeth, because people wanted Elizabeth to be the queen who were part of the Protestant idea, okay? So what she does is she takes her half-sister, who she loves so much, and she locks her away in a tower, okay? Yeah, I know some of you are like, man, I wish I could do that to my sibling, right? So she locks her away in a tower. She's there for about a year. And then Mary invites Elizabeth when she thinks she's going to have her baby. Now, it's not a scene of endearment. She's not doing it where she's like, I want my sister to share this moment with me. It's really, I'm going to rub it in your face because you're never going to be queen because I'm about to have a child. That's really what it was, okay? But what happens is, turns out it's not a child. She had probably some form of cancer that made her bigger, and she died. Yeah, right? Yay. So then you get Elizabeth, or Elizabeth, and she looks like the Queen of Hearts there. Okay, Kate Blanchett is Elizabeth. If you've seen the movie, it's so much fun. So that's where we're going to conclude. Dixon's going to pick up from that. Elizabeth brings back the Church of England and kind of solidifies that Protestant idea. But what's beautiful about Elizabeth is she takes account in the history of the Roman Catholic Church, and she also opens herself up to the Protestant ideas. Okay, so she kind of is walking that fine line of that tradition that we inherited, but also the newness of the Reformation. And I think that's Elizabeth I. Hey, look at that. And that is to be continued till next week. Okay, you like that, Dixon? And I got it under 11. I cannot believe I did that. So thank you. So thank you very much. So thank you all for coming. Real quick, I know you guys had, Sarah, you want to say something? Yes. Yeah, we have time to write down questions. I will say that we did take time to look over your questions from last week, and they were awesome. And we are pretty convinced that most of your questions will be answered over the course of this time. But I will say that the questions do kind of help dictate how we teach this, because my lesson was completely redone based on the questions that you had last week. So thank you all for your feedback in that. You'll see something.
Any other questions for Nick?
Just on the floor? Oh, for Nick, yeah. Questions Nick will answer. Was he? What was Calvin? Was
he?
Yeah.
Calvin?
Yeah.
Oh, got it.
I think we want to say Scottish because the roots of Presbyterianism in Scotland, but I don't know if that's true.
No, I don't think he was Scottish.
I don't think that's right. Can anybody Google it? Does anybody know?
That's a good question.
That's a really
where did the name Methodist come from?
Super excited. I get nervous. Okay, so let me throw this back on. So Methodist was actually a derogatory term for people who followed John Wesley. It was a word that they made up to kind of make fun of these fringe people in the Anglican tradition, because John Wesley, he was extremely organized. He was not Mr. Personality at all. But the genius of John Wesley was that he knew how to create this organization. He created small groups and levels of these small groups and kept it very intact. And it was a very methodical way of doing evangelism. And so the other Anglicans who weren't part of that just called them Methodists as kind of a joke. And they kind of adopted it as that Methodist. Now, you don't get the term United Methodist till the 60s, where they come in with the United Brethren. But they're all United Methodists now. But up to that point. And I will say that when the Methodist Church started, particularly in America, they were called the Methodist Episcopal Church until after the Civil War. So they were still embedded in who we are as Episcopalian.
The AME Church.
I don't want to give you wrong stuff. They're connected with the Methodists as well. Their AME originally stood for African Methodist Episcopal. And so what happened in America is we had this thing called segregation, you know, part of our history. So we would have the Black Methodist churches that were separate, and that's kind of where it came from. The AME Church, I don't know how it's connected to our denomination. It is, right, in some form? Not formally. And it's the same in the Methodist tradition, too, is they go to, like, their general conference, but they're not, like, an official part of either denomination. But that's where it originally comes from. They weren't British. But also, right after the Revolutionary War, a lot of Methodists were called, you guys have probably heard the term circuit riders, where they went out into the frontier. These were John Wayne guys. And they would have 6, 7, 8 churches that they would kind of circuit through. They were very, very good and organized to get that out. So that's how it grew so much in the American tradition. The Episcopal Church got very small at that time because, again, even though our name wasn't Anglican, it was still traditionally connected with the British tyranny. So that's kind of why. A lot of people found themselves in the Methodist tradition that were originally in the Episcopal because they were kind of anti-British at the time. But again, it goes back to John Wesley being super organized and how they did that here in America.
We are the Church of Presidents.
Yes, we are the Church of Presidents. That's right. So anybody else? Cool. I tell you what, if you're like me and you walk out going, I had a really good question, because that's how I am at everything, particularly the doctor's office, email us, ask us about them. We love having these conversations. We want you guys to have dialogue in this. We want you guys to know, this is why I'm Episcopalian, or this is what makes us unique, or this is what makes this denomination unique. Okay? Cool? And then come find us afterwards. So thank you all for coming this morning. We got 3 minutes too. We're good.